From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump returned to Washington this morning after his first visit to U.S. troops in a combat zone, that secret trip to Iraq yesterday. While there, he told U.S. troops, "The Democrats don't want to let us have strong borders." This morning, he tweeted out about the ongoing partial government shutdown caused by the disagreement over his demand for a border wall, writing, "Do the Dems realize that most of the people not getting paid are Democrats?" NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley has been following the goings-on. Hi, Scott.
Good morning.
So the president's critics are jumping on his bringing partisan politics to the troops, you know, assuming there are no Democrats among them, while telling them that Democrats don't want security. But outside of that, would you say this was a good moment for the president because he defied the critics who said he was afraid to go to a war zone?
It was certainly a dramatic moment for the president, a way to grab the spotlight. And it's usually a good look when a president plays the role of commander-in-chief, meets with the well-respected men and women in uniform who are out there serving their country. Typically, when presidents do that, though, they do steer clear of partisan politics. And as you mentioned, President Trump made no effort to do that. He treated this visit as if he were speaking to one of his own partisan campaign rallies, as opposed to nonpartisan members of the military who were representing presumably all Americans.
Well, let's listen to what he said about Syria, for instance. He told reporters how generals made repeated requests for more time to fight ISIS in Syria in the year leading up to the president's other surprise, the announcement last week that he's pulling troops from Syria. Let's listen.
And they said, "Sir, could we have 6 more months? I said, "Yep, you got 6 more months. Let's go." And I gave him 6 months. Then I said, "Let's get out." And they said, "Sir, could we have 6 more months? I said, "Yep, you got 6 more months." And then they said again recently, "Could we have more time?" I said, "Nope, you can't have any more time."
Now, in this case, he was speaking to reporters, but he's standing there, you know, with uniformed officers. It seemed odd to be sort of in some ways dissing the generals in front of the troops.
Well, and he did backpedal just a bit from some of the things he has said about the Islamic State. Just a week ago, he was tweeting that ISIS had been completely defeated. That was his rationale for withdrawing troops from Syria. But he now concedes what the military people have been saying, which is that while ISIS no longer controls substantial territory in either Iraq or Syria, their group has not been completely eliminated and could still pose a threat. It's certainly not a secret that the president has long been skeptical of, you know, foreign military entanglements. But it is interesting that he talked there about being guided by these six-month timetables. Remember, former President Obama was sometimes criticized by Republicans for using a calendar rather than conditions on the ground to guide his troop decisions.
Yeah. Well, again, it's hard to imagine that he could talk about ISIS being defeated in front of troops who know the truth about ISIS in that region. But let's stay with that speech to the truth, to the troops. Trump erroneously said he gave them their first raise in a decade. And then, again, remarks.
I'm not sure that's erroneous. He's been called out on that multiple times. So I think he's deliberately distorting the facts.
I see what
there.
You're saying. He might have purposely said erroneously that he gave the troops their first raise in a decade. And then, again, talking to reporters, he tried to drive a wedge between the Democratic leaders, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, who, again, are against the border wall, which is the issue that started the government shutdown. Let's listen.
Nancy Pelosi is calling the shots, not Chuck. And Chuck wants to have this done. I really believe that. He wants to have this done. But she's calling the shots, and she's calling them because she wants the votes. And probably if they do something, she's not going to get the votes, and she's not going to be Speaker of the House. And that would be not so good for her.
What's going on here?
You know, this is very much the same point that the president made when Nancy Pelosi was sitting alongside Senator Chuck Schumer with him there in the Oval Office. And you might remember, Robin, the future Speaker of the House said, "Mr. President, don't characterize my position or the strength of the Democrats who just won a substantial midterm election." I suspect she would say much the same if she'd been there with the president in Iraq. He is suggesting that she is acting out of weakness, and she would say quite the contrary, that she is doing the bidding of the people that gave Democrats a majority in the House.
Well, he probably well knows also that the name Nancy Pelosi is like an electric charge to a lot of his base. But just very briefly, just have a few seconds, 6th day of the shutdown, what's the sense of where it's going?
There are no obvious negotiations underway. The Senate is due to reconvene this afternoon, but that may be largely ceremonial. No real sign of back and forth. My colleagues on the Hill are suggesting any resolution is likely going to have to wait until Nancy Pelosi and the new Democratic House take office early next week. At that point, Democrats have promised to pass a bill aimed at reopening the parts of the government that are currently shut down, and maybe then we'll see some real talks.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley, thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, the stock market opened lower this morning after a wild post-Christmas rally yesterday. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 1,000 points Wednesday, about 5%. It was an historic surge that has investors wondering whether it was all a sucker's rally or whether the market is finally out of bear market territory. For more, let's bring in Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Jeremy.
So traders have been reporting that 20-year veterans were watching these gains yesterday with their mouths open. They were so astonished. Where did that rally come from, and can it last?
Well, so the obvious caveat applies that you're never quite sure 100% why people are buying and selling in such a hurry like we saw this week. But that said, going into yesterday, I think there were plenty of investors who thought that the recent declines in the market had gone way too far, especially after the almost 3% drop in benchmark indexes and really just half a day of trading on Christmas Eve. And then there was news that sort of gave it an added oomph, such as signs that holiday retail sales were pretty good, and that the president had expressed confidence in both Fed Chairman Jay Powell and Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, and also that the U.S. government was sending a trade delegation to travel to Beijing in 2 weeks. So those sort of news items alleviated a lot of the most acute concerns of the market about President Trump and his plans for the Fed chairman, and also about the trade tensions that have really been overhanging this market all year.
It was kind of amazing to listen to some of the analysis yesterday after the markets closed and all the optimism out there after when you look back at the year at this point. The stock market is down for the year. So like if you go back to January 1st and where we are now, the Dow, I think, is down a couple thousand points, maybe almost 10%. So overall, that's what we're seeing. But listen to this. This is Scott Minard, head of investing at Guggenheim, talking on CNBC. He said, we're close enough to a bottom that investors should be stepping in. Here he is.
Are you calling the bottom for the equity market, Scott?
I think it's nearby, Brian. I would be a buyer more than a seller at this point.
What do you think about all the optimism that you hear from analysts when you see a day like yesterday, even in the context of the bigger picture?
So there are sort of two schools of thought that are most prevalent on Wall Street right now. One is that the market is forward-looking, and it's really warning and sort of predicting a pretty nasty slowdown in the economy next year. But the other real prevalent school of thought is that markets can get irrational, that this drop is really gone way too far. The problem I see is that, you know, there's this famous quote from John Maynard Keynes that says, you know, the market can stay irrational a lot longer than you as an investor can stay solvent. Mm-hmm. So I sort of am in the camp that this drop is a little irrational. It's gone too far. But there is that sense that, you know, it could go farther. Markets can remain irrational longer than it seems logical. So calling the bottom is very tricky exercise because of that.
Well, and this was Art Cashin, director of floor operations at UBS Financial Services, also on CNBC, saying that, you know, the rally that we saw yesterday, we've seen a lot of those in previous drops. Here you go.
From the fall of Lehman until the bottom in March of 2009, the S&P had 13 4% rally, one-day rallies.
13 4% one-day rally. So this does happen, and then maybe it doesn't speak to the larger trend.
Yeah, he's absolutely right. Some of the biggest one-day gains you see are often in the middle of very nasty bear markets. That said, a lot of times, sometimes at least, the market does find a bottom and has this really strong bounce off of it like we saw yesterday. I think he's right, though, that this what they call the volatility regime on Wall Street, in other words, just the climate of the market has shifted noticeably, especially when you compare it to last year, 2017. It was just this quiet march higher without a lot of big swings one way or the other. That has certainly gone away, and it's probably going to stay this way for the near future. And in a way, it's getting back to a more normal environment. I mean, what we saw last year was the anomaly. We're actually closer to a more typical market regime now, with big swings one way or the other, believe it or not, than compared to what we saw last year, which was just such an unusual event where the market was so calm.
I saw a lot of tweets today that said maybe President Trump should have stayed in Iraq, because when he was there, the market went up 1,000 points. Now people looking forward to the idea. There are rumors now that President Trump and Jay Powell, the chairman of the Fed, could meet in person after all the public disagreement that we've heard, especially coming from President Trump. Wonder what that might do to the markets, and we will have to see. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
. 2018 was a big year for architect Balkrishna Doshi. In March, at the age of 90, he became the first Indian to win his profession's highest honor, the Pritzker Prize. Doshi has been called the father of sustainable architecture in India. He's known for work that combines traditional Indian design and modernist principles, an approach he has applied in projects as diverse as an underground art gallery and a low-income housing complex the size of a small city. I spoke with Balkrishna Doshi via Skype shortly after he won the Pritzker, and I started by asking how winning felt.
Well, absolutely touching, very emotional. And I am not only surprised, but I am grateful.
Well, tell us a little bit about your work. The Pritzker Committee said you've always created an architecture that is serious, never flashy, or a follower of trends.
I think the kind of architecture that I do is connected to my own place, the ground. So it has to be rooted, because in the changing and constantly uncertain circumstances, there is no other way but to find connections between small and big and diverse situations. The sun is very hot in certain times. Monsoon comes, you know, and flooding rushes. Then winter is reasonable. Then there are hot winds. But otherwise, if you close the house, it is stuffy. So what one tries to do is almost like clothing. You know, you try to create ways and means of creating projections, openings, enclosures, cross ventilation, so that you really feel always that you would like to be inside rather than outside.
So how much for you is about utility versus the beauty of the place?
No, I would give them equal, because I think if utility is not there, you are not comfortable. And then if you see the beauty, you would notice. But if you see the beauty, but then suddenly the comfort is not there, then I think your attention to that beauty would reduce. So I think you have to have equal balance as much as possible.
I was reading an interview that you did, and you said that the perfect architecture will allow you to really explore your own thoughts in a way that you wouldn't otherwise.
Yes. Actually, what happens is that, you know, if you were a child, when I was a child, I was wandering anywhere, you go, you have a sense of freedom, and suddenly you discover something which you had not discovered before. And I think the most important thing is that our subtle nuances in our sensitivities, if we cannot really relate them to the outside or allow them to connect with the unknown, the unexperienced, I think new thoughts don't come, because surprise is one of the very important elements for creativity.
And where did you first experience that?
I first experienced in my grandfather's house, climbing up and down those dark, semi-dark staircases. And then suddenly you come to a courtyard, and then you go to the terrace and you see a very little plant. And you feel the differences between all these. And then it is quite silent, you know, compared to the street, you know, on which the house is. So you do get this contrast, you know, when there's hot, you sit, you know, in the, and you look at the moonlight. The skies are very beautiful in India. And I think we used to sleep on the terrace. And I think it was very pleasant, cooler, because the wind was blowing. And in a few minutes or maybe 20 minutes, you know, the whole place becomes cool and you feel so happy and relaxed. I think those experiences I try to remember. And then I go back to see buildings in India, the old buildings or palaces and others. And I discovered that they had imbibed these things in their work. They had manipulated the way surprises would happen. If there is a hard sun, how do you get reflected light? If there was a breeze, how do you catch the breeze? Do you find some scoops in the roof and then the breeze would come down instead of a fan which is hung on the ceiling? Given the situation, how does one highlight or discover and create a situation by which you get what you want without thinking that you will get it? And I think that's the surprise.
You worked with the famous modernist architects Louis Kahn and Le Corbusier, whom you called the guru. How did they influence your work?
Well, they talked to me about life. We never discussed architecture, either with Corbusier or Kahn. Corbusier, you know, I was younger, much younger. And he was showing me how people move, how people behave, how birds and animals go through the house, how shadows happen, what does the sun do. Then he would look at the miniature paintings and look at how our ancient traditions are, where there are beautiful terraces and balconies and jharukhas. And Kahn, on the other hand, talked to me about the shadow, but he talked about the ethereal quality. You know, he would talk about the sun, which hits the wall of the brick, and the brick gets highlighted because the brick is not, it is almost semi-handmade, and you could get the textures of the brick. And they both became, for me, gurus in different ways. Kahn admired Corbusier because of the ability to dream and explore and do the unexpected. But for me, Kahn also gave me the idea of the immaterial, you know, what was inherent in me in India, which I was not aware. I became aware because Kahn talked about the spirit of the unknown and what that spirit means. You know, he would say, what would the building like to be? What does the brick want to say? And I think all those things combined together is what I am trying to do and then discover myself. Techniques that I find here, like in South India, the columns are not the same. Each column is different, and though they have the same geometric order of structure, and suddenly one realizes the columns also are alive because the statue or the sculpture or the figure starts talking to you. So how can the inert matter becomes alive? And I think they did not think, you know, that you need column has to be only pure and round or whatnot. But here, the columns were exaggerated, you know, by their expressive attitude of almost as if they were living being. And I think these are the kind of elements I learned from India.
You mentioned columns, by the way. There's a project that you did in Ahmedabad, an underground art gallery, and many of us were looking at pictures of it and noticed that it reminded us of Gaudi. Was that where you got that idea, or was it completely separate?
No. It was actually an accident. I was doing this in ferrocement building, and before I was doing ferrocement building, I had thought of putting columns in certain places, which I had done. And I had taken a hollow hume pipe, cement pipe, and I had located them there. And when I decided to use ferrocement, the junctions which came between the walls or the curvature that happened, I think they and the column below did not work now. So what I had to do was find a way. So I found a bamboo stick and I created the gravity, force of gravity, and created those. And then the column was somewhere else, and I tried to match that with the curvature, which is a little away. So they are actually not functional in a sense, but they are combining now what was before, what is new, and what can be done so something else would come. So even for me, it has been a great surprise.
You also mentioned scale, and I want to ask you about another one of your projects, the Aranya low-cost housing, which is home to 60,000 people. Did you have any feelings of overcrowding while you were putting together something like that?
You know, I also get surprised when I still recollect that there are 60,000 people. But when you start with a blank plate or earth, and then you start doing plinth, when you do plinths, you know, of 50, 100, etc., you don't realize what you are doing. And slowly, these people come and settle there as if they're settling on a slightly raised platform with a little tap and a toilet there. So when that happened, their scales were extremely narrow. If I had taken the municipal bylaws, I would have never done these buildings. But because they had doing their own buildings and nobody was controlling them, they found minimum ways of using maximized utility of spaces. And that's how the scale changed. So today, 60,000 people, you don't notice them because the houses are small houses, like towns. So it's very human. You don't feel overcrowded. And I think that is what I learned again, that if you want to do things, break them into small components. So it was not a combination of one building. It is like having many, many small buildings. Actually, they're all small segments, or like a honeycomb. A small segments put together, then it becomes a big thing.
What's your favorite building that is not one of yours, but anywhere in the world, something that you are inspired by?
I think Fatehpur Sikri, to me, still fascinates me, and the South Indian temple. Fatehpur Sikri, because it is on one single unit, columns, you know, one material, one simple pattern, and almost like a prefab, you know, you get stone slabs and columns. And it grows so beautifully that you always go there, and there is no tree incidentally there in that whole campus. But what a beautiful place, because there are a lot of places of shade, and then a lot of variations when you move there, because you are meandering, you are all the time going with the shadow and light, and you are always wanting to be in the shadow, but you have to shift, because the plan is shifting, the building shifts. Then you look at Indian sculptures, Indian paintings, and the way India tries to do traditionally the fulfillment of everything. And I think this is what I learned.
That's Balkrishna Doshi, who is the winner of this year's Pritzker Prize for Architecture, joining us from India on Skype. Balkrishna Doshi, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure having you today.
No, thank you, Mr. Hobson. Thanks a lot for all this. Thank you.
I spoke with Balkrishna Doshi in March. You can see some of his work at hereandnow.org.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Authorities in Indonesia have raised the alert level again for the Anak Krakatau volcano that triggered that devastating tsunami last Saturday, killing at least 430 people, displacing over 20,000. Flights are being rerouted around the area. 15,000 residents living within a 3-mile radius of this volcano that rises out of the sea between the islands of Sumatra and Java have been ordered to evacuate. And many are remembering that this week marks the 14-year anniversary of that horrific 2004 tsunami, which killed more than 230,000 people across 14 countries, over 168,000 in Indonesia alone. Let's bring in Dr. Janine Krippner, a volcanologist at Concord University in West Virginia. Doctor, there was criticism that the tsunami warning system in Indonesia didn't predict Saturday's tsunami, but we now know it didn't go off because this tsunami wasn't caused by an earthquake. It was caused by a big part of the wall of the volcano collapsing into the ocean, displacing water. So now the alert level is raised again. What are people thinking?
I've had a few people contact me saying they're just, it's hard to describe. It's so heartbreaking. They're saying that they're extremely uneasy, just so aware of the volcano being there, not sure what's going to happen, and they don't know what to do.
Yeah. And this is not new to this area, obviously, the horror of 2004. So compare this structure, though, this Anak Krakatau, which means child of Krakatau, because Krakatau, another volcano, you know, also had a devastating earthquake. This landmass grew out of that. It's been kind of burping and rattling for quite a while now.
Yeah, so Anak Krakatau is part of the exact same system, so the same volcanic system, but it's been slowly rebuilding itself. So the volcano actually begins below the ocean and has built itself up above the ocean, but now we've seen a large portion of that collapse into the ocean.
Yeah. So how do people there, how would you suggest people there protect themselves? They are living right up against the ocean.
Yes, the current recommendation is to stay away from the beach, at least 500 meters to a kilometer from the beach in the Sunda Strait area. And we don't know how stable the remaining volcanic material is. We don't know if there's going to be any more tsunamis. The tsunamis wouldn't be triggered by the current activity that is happening now, but we just don't know what it's going to do next.
Look, we have a lot of stories, Doctor, about different events around the world. Where would you put this on your list of concerns?
Oh, God, that's a good question. I just don't know. We just can't tell how stable or unstable the remaining material is. It might not produce another collapse. It might. The volcanic eruption itself, the volcano has been erupting since around June this year. So if it continues the way that it has, everything should be okay.
And it sounds like you're saying, but if more walls fall off, that's a different story.
Exactly. And the volcano goes down under the ocean, and it's pretty steep down there. So collapses can occur under the ocean surface, and they can trigger tsunamis as well. So it's not just what's remaining on the surface that we can see, but it's things we can't see that we have to worry about too.
Yeah. Dr. Jeanine Krippner, volcanologist at Concord University in West Virginia, watching what's going on in Indonesia. Doctor, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Keeping an eye on what we can't see.
This is Here and Now. The holidays are a big time for charitable giving, especially in a strong economy. But charities this year are concerned that they will see less money in donations because of changes from the tax law President Trump signed last December. That law increased the standard deduction, meaning for many, it now makes less sense to itemize deductions and tabulate all of your charitable contributions. As a result, researchers at Indiana University say people may donate less. Joining us now is Una Osili. She led the research. She's an associate dean at Indiana University's Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you for having me.
And let's start with what exactly is different this year. The tax law that the Republicans passed nearly doubled the standard deduction to around $12,000 for individuals. And for couples, it's now $24,000. Why is that important for charitable giving?
So as you've noted, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was passed at the end of December 2017, and it brought some changes to American households and especially taxpayers who are now facing some new financial decisions. In the past, about a third of Americans itemized their deductions, which meant that a third could take advantage of the charitable deduction. What we estimate today is that probably less than 10% of Americans will itemize under the new tax law because it will be more advantageous for many households to just take the standard deduction, which means they will not list or itemize their charitable giving and therefore not benefit from the tax incentives that are associated with charitable giving.
And that's a pretty big drop-off that you're talking about there, from a third to 10%.
That's a pretty big drop-off. Yes, absolutely. And it doesn't mean that Americans will not continue to give. We know that tax incentives are not the only reason that many Americans give. But research does show that tax incentives affect the amount that households give, the timing of their gifts, and often the vehicles that they use to make those charitable contributions.
So some believe that this is a bit alarmist, that there is not going to be a big drop-off in charitable giving. Have you actually seen evidence that people are going to be giving less to charities because of this?
I think it's too early to say very definitively exactly what impact tax reform will have on giving. What we have started to see so far is that some households are beginning to adopt a particular strategy around their giving. For example, they may choose to make a big charitable gift in 1 year rather than spreading it across several years. We're also seeing some households expressing interest in particular vehicles around charitable giving and the form of the charitable giving that they may make, whether that's a cash donation or appreciated stock or other forms of giving. And especially for households who are working with a financial advisor or who may have other assets other than cash to give, it does make some sense to have more strategy. I do agree that it's too early to tell. Many households are still figuring this out because this is fairly recent from a policy standpoint and a data standpoint. So it's going to take a few years before we have the exact answer to the question, how does tax reform actually affect American households?
And but I imagine that nonprofits are not waiting around. What are they doing to prepare for these changes?
So nonprofits of different sizes and subsectors are going to feel these impacts differently. Nonprofits that depend primarily on wealthy households may not be as impacted by these changes. However, nonprofits that benefit from donations across the income spectrum and certainly everyday Americans and their giving have actually started to talk to donors about this, emphasizing that their gifts are still eligible for the charitable deduction, but it really does depend on their tax situation. Nonprofits that are in different parts of the country may also be messaging differently to their donors because nonprofits in high-tax states may actually have a different set of recommendations for donors.
Were there any changes in the tax law that are going to affect how corporations give to charities or how much they can deduct?
Well, certainly there is some change in the tax code for corporations where they have the taxes that corporations are assessed was reduced. So there, in principle, corporations may have more after-tax profits to donate or to invest back into the company. And so some companies we've seen become more, I guess, attuned to ways that they can support charitable giving at either at the community level or through supporting where their employees are giving. So there's certainly some changes for corporations as well.
I guess the optimistic or idealistic way of looking at this is people are going to give to charity whether they're getting a tax deduction or not. Maybe that's not the way it works in reality, but how important is that tax deduction when people are deciding whether they're going to give money to charity?
I think the research shows that taxes are not the primary motivation for giving in the first place. So that decision to give or not to give is motivated by a host of other variables, some of them economic, whether you have the income, the wealth, the means to give, but also your connection to a cause, your social networks, whether you're asked to give or not. So all of those drive the decision to give. Where we see tax incentives really affecting how households behave and their decision-making is in the amount that they give. So whether they give a large amount or small amount, similarly, the timing of their gift. So this idea of bunching your gift and making a large gift in 1 year so that you can maximize your tax benefit is an adaptation or could be a response to tax reform. And then the vehicle that you choose, certainly tax incentives can affect whether you give appreciated stock versus a cash donation versus some other type of asset. So I think while the decision to give or not give is motivated by a host of factors, the timing and the amount and the way, manner and vehicle that donors use is certainly sensitive to tax incentives.
And what about the strength of the economy? If we're looking at a possible economic slowdown in the near or maybe not so near future, how does that affect how much people are giving for charity?
The biggest driver of overall charitable giving that we've seen over time is the overall state of the economy. That includes growth in the economy, both in the real sector, so what's happening with household incomes, with employment, with consumption, but also what's happening in financial markets, because we know that wealth affects giving. In other words, people give when they feel financially and economically secure. And so really, when we look ahead to what will in fact affect giving in 2018 and beyond, the overall strength of the economy has a lot to do with this. And when there is uncertainty in terms of whether there will be some economic slowdown ahead, that does have the potential to also influence how households make their giving decisions.
What makes somebody decide in the first place to give? Is it, and then maybe they give every year after that. Is it because they're asked to do it? Is it because they see that their friends do it? What is the big driver to get people to become givers?
I think there are a complex array of factors that affect that giving decision, but by far one of the drivers of giving is being asked and awareness of a cause. So knowing where to give, knowing about an issue, and also having that opportunity to give is really one of the biggest factors. But people's social networks affect their giving. And today we know that that can be direct in-person interactions, but also social media interactions and online messages that might raise awareness and motivate a donor to give. In addition, awareness has all kinds of forms, and someone learning about an issue, whether that's a local issue, a national issue, or even an international issue, such as the global refugee crisis, can motivate a donor to give. And increasingly, I think there are many ways that donors can learn about causes, and that can actually lead a donor to make a gift. And once they make that gift, the nonprofit then has the opportunity to engage that donor and hopefully build a long-term relationship with that donor so that they continue to support that organization or that cause over time.
That is Una Osili, who is an associate dean at Indiana University's Lilly Family School of Philanthropy. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And let's take a minute to take stock of the year in sports. Now think for a second of your favorite story. And Jeremy, while they're thinking, I'd forgotten that there was an Olympics.
How
year.
Could you forget the curling people? Remember the curling people? They were great.
They were. Now that you remind me, LeBron James left Cleveland again. There was that Supreme Court decision legalizing sports gambling across the country. Mike Pesca is here now as a sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. He joins us. And Mike, that sound you're hearing is people thinking of their sports story. But you start with gambling. The Supreme Court struck down that federal law that prohibited most states from authorizing sports betting. A handful of states have taken advantage, but, you know, what's really changed?
Well, a lot will change. A lot has changed because there were states who had anticipated this and they were ready to go. And so states like Pennsylvania and Delaware, boom, right off the bat, they started having New Jersey also sports gambling. And there are more states in the pipeline. And you're going to see it, even if you have no interest in sports gambling or never thought you had an interest, you're going to begin to see this in a couple of years. We will probably remember back to 2018, early 2018, 2017, as the time where you could watch sports or watch some content about sports without being inundated with the over, under, and the spread, and who to pick, because I really believe all of sports broadcasting and media is going to turn, I don't know, at least a third gambling-based. It'll infuse everything you hear about sports.
Like you'll have a window, like there'll be a split screen, and you'll be seeing how the betting's going.
I have to say, that'd be cool.
Oh, God. Okay, look, the NFL is eventually going to have a team in Las Vegas. I want to make sure we get this in here. You know, the Raiders are going to move there. Do you see a problem with that?
No, I don't. I think that's a mindset from years and years ago, which is physical proximity to a place where sports gambling is legal would lead to nefarious deeds. And of course, since now sports gambling is legal, look, I went to a Jets game the other day and they share a parking lot with a facility where you can bet on the NFL. Now, not actually during the Jets game. They shut it down for those 3 hours. But it's going to be ubiquitous. And I don't think there's a lot of technology to prevent games being thrown. I don't think that that will be a big problem, especially among highly paid millionaire athletes.
Okay. Mike, this was the year that LeBron James took his talents to Los Angeles. He signed a 4-year, $154 million contract with the Lakers. Just helped the Lakers beat the defending NBA champs, the Golden State Warriors, on Christmas Day. But how is this move going so far for James and for LA?
Yeah, underpaid, if you ask me, and by all metrics. I'm serious. You know, so the Lakers, they lost their first three with LeBron, and they didn't get to an above 500 team until 13 games in. But now they're 20-14, and they just beat the world champion Golden State Warriors on Golden State's court, which is something they hadn't done since 2012. It's going great, and it's because LeBron James has shown that pretty much whoever you surround him with, he will be, just him alone can will a team or talent a team. All right, there I go. If I'm taking my talent to South Beach, I'll use that as a verb. To an elite status. He's that good. So he did get hurt in the game. He has a groin injury. He's day to day. As the old saying goes, aren't we all? And he's never experienced a long stretch of injuries. But right now, today, you'd have to say the Lakers are a strong possibility to at least be in the Western Conference Finals.
Well, and if LeBron brings them to the finals, that would be his ninth straight NBA Finals with many different teams. What about the NFL, Mike? We've talked to you a lot about it this season. There's been a lot of controversy over the national anthem protests. But do you think that things changed in 2018 for the NFL?
I think, well, we do talk about it a lot, and it's justified because I do think it is the dominant entertainment of America. If you look at 75 of the top 100 most watched TV shows, they were NFL games, and they continue to be. And when there was a blip, when the NFL, and I do consider a blip, it was a few-year downward trend. And then there was a confluence of a couple of stories that were related to each other. Quarterback Colin Kaepernick taking a knee in protest of police brutality. Donald Trump jumping on that to make it an issue to campaign on. And at the same time, there was a small dip in ratings. I think a lot of people saw correlation there. I just saw that they were all occurring at the same time. And now NFL ratings are a bit up. And the other big story of 2018, like that's the macro sense, and that's where the league is. But the other big story was the Philadelphia Eagles winning the Super Bowl, which for a city like Philadelphia, which loves its Eagles beyond all else, and they love their sports team, that was a thing that they never thought would happen. And if you ask them with 2 weeks to go in the regular season last year, they probably didn't think it will happen. Though this year, it looks like it's not going to happen again.
Well, I'm glad you got it in there from last year. And I just want to mention on the LeBron James, another big story of the year was that he and Laura Ingraham got him into that fight, and she told him to shut up and just dribble. That was a big moment in sports. Gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar sentenced last January. There was the weirdness during Serena Williams' final at Wimbledon. But just what else jumps out at you?
Well, the Olympics, if we remember how North Korea used that for diplomacy.
Mm-hmm. If we remember the Olympics.
yeah. And the two Koreas competing under the same flag. Right. Again, correlation, not causation, but there was some international diplomacy that happened. And the other huge event that most of the world, anywhere but America, would be saying, well, of course the World Cup, and congratulations to France. But I think the headline of the World Cup was just how poorly Germany did, seeing all those multisyllabic German headlines afterwards, which even if you don't read German, they just screamed pain and desperation. Although, don't many German words do that?
I think the way we could remember the next Olympics, Robin, is if we just go to them. That would work.
Excellent idea. Mike, from your lips.
Mike Pesca here, now sports analyst. Thanks. Happy New Year.
It's
okay,
here
see
now.
You in Tokyo.